From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, a talk with Joan Plowright on acting and on being part of one of England's great acting couples. For many years, she was married to Sir Laurence Olivier. Also today, making movies with Stephen Frears, director of My Beautiful Laundrette, Dangerous Liaisons, and The Grifters, which just came out on home video. And TV critic David Bianculli has a good reason to watch some really bad movies. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Korva Coleman. White House Chief of Staff John Sununu announced today that he will not resign because of the controversy surrounding his travel habits. Sununu told reporters that he was not disturbed by his situation. He's vowed to retain his post until at least President Bush's second term. The White House has placed new travel restrictions on Sununu. More than a dozen AIDS activists, critical of the American Medical Association's positions on AIDS and related topics, were arrested today outside an AMA meeting in Chicago. NPR Cheryl Duvall has this report.
About 300 demonstrators from the AIDS Coalition to Unleash Power marched around the downtown Chicago hotel where the AMA House of Delegates is holding its annual meeting. The protesters, surrounded by an equal number of police, contend that the medical establishment regards health care as a privilege for those who can pay and disregards the knowledge of people with various illnesses. ACT UP member Daryl Moore.
The main reason why we're demonstrating is because people with AIDS and with cancer and with chronic fatigue syndrome are not in there talking about their expertise.
AMA representatives met with a small group of ACT UP members during the weekend, but the protesters called the meeting a token dialogue. The convention continues through Thursday. In Chicago, I'm Cheryl Duvall reporting.
Delegates to the Teamsters Union convention today booed a videotaped speech by President Bush and remarks by their outgoing president. The 2,000 delegates are meeting in Florida to choose candidates for the first open election of the union's president. The election is part of a settlement of a Justice Department racketeering lawsuit. That suit charged that union leaders engaged in widespread corruption with the mob. Many Teamsters are angry over the suit's settlement and blame President Bush and outgoing Teamster President William McCarthy for coming to terms with the Justice Department. Substantial breakthroughs were reached during the first of 3 days of peace talks by leaders of the four warring Cambodian factions who are meeting in the Supreme National Council. Michael Sherry reports from Bangkok.
The Phnom Penh government and the three factions of the resistance ratified an unconditional ceasefire and a stop to foreign weapons shipments. But the day closed with dashed hopes for a lasting peace. Resistance leader Prince Norodom Sihanouk announced that Phnom Penh Prime Minister Hun Sen had rejected a key United Nations peace plan. Only yesterday, the prince declared the civil war over after 12 long years. The Khmer Rouge, which is militarily the strongest faction of the resistance, sees the UN plan as a way of dismantling the Phnom Penh regime and its armed forces. But Phnom Penh wants guarantees that these will remain in place at least until elections are held. For National Public Radio, this is Michael Sherry in Bangkok.
On Wall Street today, stocks closed lower. The Dow Jones Industrials fell 52 points to close at 29.13. This is NPR. Dr. Bernadine Healy was sworn in today as the first woman to head the National Institutes of Health. Healy was chosen after a 2-year vacancy in the National Medical Post. She takes on the position at the country's premier biomedical research center after serving as chair of the Cleveland Clinic Foundation's Research Institute. Healy said her goal is better health for all Americans. Scientists participating in a United Nations study of the Kuwaiti oil fires have been flying research planes through the smoke plumes for the last month. Today, they turned in some results at a Washington press conference. NPR's John Nielsen has more.
The smoke from the Kuwaiti oil fires isn't likely to change global weather patterns or cause dangerously acidic rainfall, the researchers said. Apparently, the soot particles in the smoke aren't getting hot enough to rise into the stratosphere where they might have been blown out of the region. This greatly reduces the chance that smoke from these Kuwaiti fires will affect the Indian monsoon season, as some have feared. Also, the smoke contains surprisingly low levels of sulfur dioxide, the key ingredient in acid rain. About 500 oil fires are still burning in Kuwait, putting 5,000 tons of soot into the atmosphere every day. The studies, funded partly by the Defense Department, will continue in August. I'm John Nielsen.
European countries reportedly plan to start up a humanitarian operation that will bring 1 million Kurds back to Iraq from their place of refuge in Iran. A French government official says a peace accord must first be signed between Kurdish rebels and the Iraqi government. The minister did not specify the details of the operation. The South African government and two black rival groups have agreed to work jointly to stop violence in townships that has claimed at least 10,000 lives since 1984. The African National Congress and the Inkatha Freedom Party have formed a preparatory committee to draft proposals on issues necessary to bring about peace. I'm Corva Coleman, National Public Radio News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. My guest, Joan Plowright, is one of England's leading actresses, and she was married to one of England's finest actors, Sir Laurence Olivier, from 1961 until his death. Plowright is best known as a stage actress, but over the past few years she's been making more movies. You may have seen her in the recent films The Dressmaker and Avalon. Now she's starring in Drowning by Numbers, a dark comedy about three women who drown their husbands. The movie was directed by Peter Greenaway, who also directed one of last year's most controversial films, the X-rated The Cook, the Thief, His Wife, and Her Lover. Drowning by Numbers, which has no rating, was shot before The Cook, the Thief. But I wondered if Plowright was worried that Drowning might generate controversy because audiences would be seeing it after The Cook, the Thief.
Peter Greenaway is obviously a very original and slightly outrageous film director. His films have always been controversial. In England, people admire, ever since the Draftsman's Contract, they've welcomed him and acclaimed that. They've been puzzled by his films afterwards, though in Paris and Germany and Sweden and everywhere else in Europe, they acclaimed all of the films. But England did sort of breathe a sigh of relief with Drowning by Numbers because they thought they could understand what was going on.
Are you used to saying lines like, "Are fat men's penises usually so small?"
No, I'm not. No, I must say, it's the first time I've ever said such a thing in my life. I found it quite amusing.
Did you have any reservations about it? It just seems very, from the roles I've seen you in, it seemed very out of character.
Well, out of what character? I mean,
They're all characters, right? Yeah.
Yes, I mean, I'm not what I play all the time. There is a bit of me in all of them. But, I can find that bit of me which finds that both outrageous and amusing to say a line like that. When I first got the script, I knew it was a fairly bizarre undertaking, very outrageous, very exhilarating, a very literate script, and to me, a very multi-layered piece of work. I mean, it's a sort of high comedy, black comedy, but underneath there's quite some serious themes.
You started acting at the Old Vic Theatre School. What was the training like there?
It was a wonderful training, but it was very specifically for, I would say, classical theatre. It was to do with voice, speech, movement, dance, fencing. Even the girls learnt fencing. It was a very serious training. And very tough. I mean, the end of each term at the Old Vic Theatre School where I trained, there were people who were told they should not continue. So it was very hard. It was very nerve-wracking. But it was a very sound and wonderful basic training.
Are you glad you learned how to fence? Has that come in useful for anything?
Well, I am glad, actually, because I played Viola in a television film of Shakespeare's Twelfth Night, And I did have to fence, because Viola dresses up as a boy, with Sir Ralph Richardson, who was playing Sir Toby. And we had quite a long sword fight, which was highly dangerous because he was no better at it than I was. But at least I'd had some training. I could look fairly good at it.
In Laurence Olivier's memoirs, he writes about the first time that you met. And he describes going backstage to congratulate all the actors at a performance of The Country Wife. And he is trying to imagine what your reaction was to him. And he says, "I divined that I stood for everything that the young generation at the royal court would find most objectionable, and everything that was most odious to a girl of this generation of actors who had come from North Lines. I was titled, necessarily self-satisfied, pompous, patronizing, having obviously come to visit in a spirit of condescension. I could see it all." What did you think about the older generation of actors and Laurence Olivier at the time? Was he accurate in those perceptions?
Half, yes. I mean, after all, we were very young. We had set up an outpost in Sloane Square at the Royal Court Theatre. We were doing the work of new contemporary writers of our own age, John Osborne, Harold Pinter.
Who is the
Tom
we that
Stopper.
You're referring to?
The company. The we was the English stage company. It was actors like Albert Finney, Alan Bates, Peter O'Toole, girls, me and Billy Whitelaw. We were most of us from the provinces, not born in London, not with Kensington, London accents. We were from all over. And we, because of the success of John Osborne's play Look Back in Anger, we were all known as angry young men and angry young women. I mean, we weren't all that angry, but we did get lumped together, and that's why I say we at the time. That was a title that was used about me in interviews, even when I first came over to New York with A Taste of Honey. Obviously, you know, he represented a theatre that we were fighting to abolish.
What did you want to abolish?
Drawing room comedies, and where people came on in white flannels with a tennis racket and said, "Anyone for tennis?" It was that sort of theatre that we were trying to get rid of. We were political. We were very left-wing. And Larry, to us, I suppose, looked very right-wing. Now, that is not to say that one was not aware of a great talent. And I think what he saw when he came and said that about me was a thing that I was, along with my friends, determined not to be impressed just because he was coming to see us. We thought, quite right, he should come and see us. We've got something very good going here. At the same time, you don't have to make a decision to not to be impressed unless somewhere inside you, you are deeply impressed, if you see what I mean.
Right, exactly.
So that's your answer, really.
When did you change your mind about Laurence Olivier and decide that he wasn't just... You had pointed out you were already very impressed with him, but still he did represent the other generation and a more conservative spirit in the theatre.
Well, obviously it was when I started rehearsing the Osborne play The Entertainer with him, and here was a man who was nothing to do with the reputation, but... an actor, an entertainer, a huge talent on that stage, came on and took off his jacket and rolled up his sleeves and acted everybody off the stage with a force and a power and an energy that was very startling. Also a man who would, you know, just go next door into the pub with all the actors and talk as a human being. Getting to know him properly was a revelation. as against the image, which I think was a wrong image anyway, but which he couldn't help having achieved.
My guest is Joan Plowright, one of the leading stage actresses in England. She's also appeared in movies. You may have seen her in the recent films The Dressmaker and Avalon. She's starring in the new movie Drowning by Numbers, which is directed by Peter Greenaway, who also directed The Cook, The Thief, His Wife, and Her Lover. We'll take a short break, then we'll talk some more. This is Fresh Air. Actress Joan Plowright is my guest. Laurence Olivier, in his book on acting, reprints some of the letters that that he wrote to you with some advice to advice on acting to you about some performances. And he said to you in one of the letters, "You don't know how lucky you are to be able to cry at will on stage. I've never been able to do it in my life."
Yes.
Was that a problem for him? And was it something that you were especially proud of being able to do?
No, because honestly, a lot of people can, you know. It isn't a gift in any way. It's a weakness, perhaps. As far as he was concerned, I mean, he could make people believe that he was crying, perhaps more powerfully than actors who were actually crying. I mean, to be on stage, you know, it is an art form. It is a craft. I mean, you can play Juliet yourself in the bathroom, lying in the bath, and move yourself quite intensely and cry real tears. If you are actually on a stage and you do it in the same way, nobody beyond the first row in the theatre is going to know at all what you're doing. They are not going to see the tears. Your voice is going to be clogged with emotion anyway, so they're not going to hear. What Larry could do was project an image of somebody in great grief and crying without actually doing it. Now, that is great acting, and it is often more powerful than the real thing. That is in theatre we're talking about. On film, it would be totally different.
One other thing that Laurence Olivier wrote you in a letter that I wanted to mention, he wrote, "A humbler approach to our work is essential, but how do we equate the essential humility towards the work with the full possession of confidence required to carry it off?" And that just struck me as a really interesting dilemma, and I wonder if that's something you feel you've had to contend with during your career, the humility that you need to really approach a role and the confidence to pull it off, especially, you know, in the light of the fear of rejection that so many actors have. I think actors are very vulnerable about that.
Yes, you're right. It is a constant problem. And it varies through stages in your life. Very early on, you probably have a great deal of confidence, but because you are still promising and you haven't yet had the knocks. I remember being interviewed by a journalist who said to me, "Why are you being so evasive with me?" He said, "You are a journalist's daughter. Surely you know the golden rule. We never knock you when you're on the way up. It's only when you get there that we'll shoot you down." Now, if that is a golden rule, it's not a very pleasant one, but it does seem to apply a great deal. And therefore, once you have achieved some kind of name or reputation, the nerves get worse. Therefore, the confidence gets more shaky because you have more to lose.
Was there a period in your life where you felt that that was really at its strongest, that sense of that you had the most to lose and your nerves were shaky?
Yes, quite possibly. At the opening of the National Theatre, my first role was St. Joan, and that was really all right because I'd done that before. We repeated two plays from a previous season when we opened the National Theatre. But the next leading role I did, I think I was more worried and shaky in confidence in that I was playing Masha in Chekhov's Three Sisters, and Larry was directing it, and I had the sort of double responsibility of him as director and being my husband, and me as leading lady, and the worry that, you know, it was... the burden might be too much. So it was a shaky start to that.
What kind of reviews did you get for that?
They were actually marvellous, as it turned out. But, the rehearsal, the preparation was the fearful time.
It must be hard when you're getting directed by your husband in something, because, I mean, there's times, I think, when you really want to resist a director. And, I don't know, when you're that close, it must be hard to take direction in a way.
Yes, it does have its problems, but then, I mean, you have to be able to argue and not feel that, you know, for the sake of his reputation in front of the rest of the company, you can't say a word. You have to be very open about that and be able to argue as any actress would who was not married to him.
When you both fell in love and decided to marry, you were both married to other people.
Yes.
And Olivia was married to Vivian Leigh, and this was a very well-known relationship. And she had sent out a public statement saying that Olivia was asking for a divorce in order to marry you. And this was at a time when you were both performing in a play together.
Yes.
And it was decided that you should leave the production. I think Olivier suggested this. You should leave the production. After her statement became public, what was the reasoning behind asking you to leave?
Oh, because he knew the amount of press attention that would be there, and he didn't think I was aware of the of how much there would be, which, of course, I wasn't.
Looking back, do you think that that was the right way to handle it?
Yes, I believe it was. It would have been ridiculous for us both to have had to leave the theatre every night to crowds of photographers and people, wouldn't it?
What are some of the problems involved with having a relationship that's a very public relationship, whether you want it to be public or not, public in the sense that, you know, you're two public people who audiences want to know about?
That is a decision to take very early on. It was one of the reasons why we chose to live in Brighton, away from London, by the sea, that we could bring up our children in comparative privacy. And you can avoid it, you know, if you want to. If you wish to lead a rather secluded private life with only chosen friends, you can do so. The fact that we had to catch a train every night to Brighton from London, it was an hour's journey, put out of the way a lot of sort of social events that we might have been involved in otherwise and which we didn't really want to be involved in. I mean, we were very, very determined to spend as much time as possible together. We had the house in Brighton by the sea, a flat in London, and a house in the country. And it was Brighton and the country where we spent a lot of time. We had a growing family. And really, you know, people who are very much in love and bringing up a family are not news value anymore as when they're having adulterous
right.
affairs and getting divorced. You know, they're not of that much interest. Their work is, but their private life, once it's settled, is not.
I think that's a very interesting point that you've just made. If you're just joining us, my guest is actress Joan Plowright, and she's starring in the new movie Drowning by Numbers. You took time off from theater to raise your children. You have three children?
Yes.
How much time did you end up taking away from acting?
It was really only 18 months each time. I mean, once it was 2 years, I think, when I had each of the children. I wanted, obviously, that bond between mother and child to be there for the first 2 years if I could, without the kind of interruption of work. It was essential to me at that stage. For that time I did it, I didn't miss the excitement, the nerves, the nerve-wracking days of dress rehearsals and previews and openings. I felt a great relief at being away from it, but then suddenly it the urge came back.
Do you ever get out of practice when you haven't acted for a couple of years?
Yes, you do get out of practice. There's just that thing of, in theatre, for instance, of stepping onto a stage for the first time. If you haven't done it for 2 years. I remember going back into a play at the Old Vic. I took over from Maggie Smith in Much Ado About Nothing at the National Theatre. We often took over from each other in parts. And I hadn't been on the stage for 2 years. And I hadn't realised that this production started with the curtain up. And at a preview, I went into the wings just 5 minutes before the curtain was due to go up, as I thought, and walked on stage to practice my first line and saw an entire house full of people who all stopped talking to each other and looked expectantly at me. And I realised that the house was in, the curtain was up, and I was not starting the play, I was merely practising. Ran off into the wings in great confusion. When the play did start, and I came on again, my throat closed on my first line, and I could not speak. And it stayed like that for, I suppose, 30 seconds of an epiglottal stop every time I tried to say the first word.
This is sounding very much like the classic actor's nightmare, but it actually happened to
you. Yes, it is. It did actually happen. It never happened again because I was more careful, but that is that kind of shock to your system, a nervous system, coming back and being out of practice can do quite alarming things.
You've made some movies in America as well as in England.
Yes.
Do you think that there's a different approach to acting and directing in America?
Well, I mean, the film industry is America. I mean, it is America's tradition. It is America's medium. And it is therefore much more relaxed over here making movies. I don't think there's fundamentally a different approach. I mean, after all, convincing, truthful acting is the same in any country, whether English-speaking or not. An audience recognises the truthful performance. Directors and actors in America simply have far more scope and much more opportunity to practice their craft than in England, where the industry is very much beleaguered at the moment.
My guest has been Joan Plowright. She stars in the new Peter Greenaway film, Drowning by Numbers, which recently opened in Boston, Chicago, Philadelphia, Seattle, and Portland. It will open in other cities later this summer. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and Apple Computer in personal computing, providing the power to be your best. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. The Grifters, starring Angelica Houston, John Cusack, and Annette Bening, just came out on home video. Coming up, we talk with the director, Stephen Frears. He also made My Beautiful Laundrette, Prick Up Your Ears, and Dangerous Liaisons. And TV critic David Bianculli knows where to go for laughs this summer, Mystery Science Theater 3000. That's all coming up on Fresh Air.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Ann Taylor. The White House says that Allied forces in the Persian Gulf War are now considering the possibility of a rapid deployment unit that would stay in the area for a while to maintain security. Spokesman Marlon Fitzwater says the new force would be an addition to a UN police force, part of which is already in Iraq. Fitzwater says that he has no details on the size of the possible force, who would take part, or where it would be located. According to various news reports, allies in Europe are calling on Washington to keep some ground troops along the Turkish-Iraqi border as part of a multinational force to protect the Kurds. On Capitol Hill, there has been another call to investigate allegations that the Reagan-Bush campaign made a deal with Iran in 1980 to delay the release of 52 American hostages until after the election. NPR's Mara Liasson has more on the story.
Senator Albert Gore of Tennessee today introduced a resolution calling for an independent commission to investigate the persistent reports about a deal for the delayed release of the hostages. In the House of Representatives, an informal inquiry is underway. Staff of key committees are examining what evidence there is of such a deal and what else might be turned up if a formal investigation, armed with subpoenas, was authorized. Today, the Speaker of the House, Thomas Foley, said that there were disconcerting and unresolved questions about events in the 1980 campaign. He said he would make a decision on whether or not to launch a formal investigation in the next few weeks. At the Capitol, I'm Mara Liasson.
The ambassador to Colombia, Thomas McNamara, says that the U.S. has doubts about the capability of Colombian judges to convict drug traffickers who have surrendered to officials. Speaking before members of the news media in Colombia, the envoy said that Washington will, however, respect the government decision not to extradite alleged drug figures. Leslie Werpsa in Bogota has more.
Ambassador McNamara criticized Colombia's judicial system for its inability to act in the past against the drug traffickers. He said the ban on extradition approved last week by Colombia's Constituent Assembly was a big mistake. But he promised that the U.S. government will respect the policy and cooperate with the Colombians, beefing up the judicial system and giving evidence to judges in charge of convicting the big-time drug smugglers. The ambassador said relations between Colombia and the United States are good right now, but problems could arise if Colombia fails to sentence the traffickers. McNamara was apparently trying to calm the press down. The local media was outraged over reported statements from Drug Policy Director Bob Martinez that Colombia is on trial for having built a cozy prison for drug trafficker Pablo Escobar. Escobar and five of his cohorts surrendered last week. For National Public Radio, I'm Leslie Werpsa in Bogota.
On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrials moved down over 52 points to close at 2,900. This is NPR News. In Washington, the U.S. Supreme Court has made it more difficult for convicted criminals to claim their rights have been violated and get help in federal court. In its two new rulings, the high court action is expected to speed up the pace of executions and are the latest in a series of rulings by the high court, making it more difficult for convicted criminals to appeal. One case involved a man on death row in Virginia and the other a man convicted of murder in California. Both rulings were made by a vote of 6-3. The Prime Minister of Yugoslavia has appealed to the Parliament of Croatia not to go ahead with its planned declaration of independence. This move is due Wednesday, the same day that Slovenia has said that it will leave the Federation. Misha Glani of the BBC reports.
Mr. Markovic pulled no punches. He warned of impending economic and social catastrophe if Croatia goes ahead with its move towards independence. He drew a dark picture of chaos in Yugoslavia, provoked by ethnic groups armed to the teeth and ready to fight. He reminded the Sabor, the Croatian parliament, that he too was a proud Croat. But he said that does not mean one has to harbour hatred and impatience, as he put it, towards other nations, a reference to the deep divisions between Croats and Serbs. He said the political disputes of the past 9 months had put Yugoslavia's development back many years, and finally he warned that he would hinder Croatia and Slovenia's move towards independence with all means at the government's disposal unless it was agreed to by all Yugoslav republics.
Misha Glenny of the BBC. In Britain, the government says that country's economy failed to grow in the first 3 months of the year, marking the third straight quarter of a lack of growth. Actually, the new study found a drop of 0.6% in the gross domestic product. This is NPR News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. If you missed The Grifters when it played in theaters, you might want to rent it this summer. It just came out on video. As New York Times film critic Vincent Canby said, it's a smashing variation on the sort of movie that people mean when they ask why Hollywood doesn't make movies the way they used to. The Grifters is about three con artists who con each other. It was adapted from a 1963 pulp novel by Jim Thompson. The movie stars Angelica Houston as Lily, John Cusack as her son Roy, and Annette Bening as Roy's girlfriend, Myra. Here are Cusack and Bening.
Roy, you're a short con operator, and a good one, I think. Don't talk to me like I'm another square.
You talk the lingo. What's your pitch?
The long end. Big con.
Nobody does that single out.
I was team 10 years with the best in the business, Cole Langley.
I've heard the name.
It was beautiful and getting better all the time.
Is that right?
It is, Roy. It's where you should be. What do you bring in, $300-$400 a week? We use money like that for tips.
Wow.
And now, right now, it's the perfect time.
The Grifters was directed by Stephen Frears. He also made My Beautiful Laundrette, Prick Up Your Ears, and Dangerous Liaisons. Frears was invited to direct The Grifters by Martin Scorsese, who produced the film. But Frears, who is British, hadn't directed a movie in America before. He told Fresh Air producer Amy Sallet that he had a lot to learn before he could direct this uniquely American story about con artists and gamblers.
I know nothing about America. I don't know anything about horse racing. I don't know what that world is like. I had to learn about it. I knew what it was like from the movies, but in real life, I had to learn about it. But people take that stuff. You can learn. You know, you can. People will take you to places and show you how to do certain kinds of tricks and things like that. That's available. Of course, the emotion, the relationships between the characters. You know, that comes from somewhere else.
Well, what did you do to prepare? Did you get people to take you to the
race? Con men would come in and show me their tricks.
Really?
Yeah, they were rather nice people, and it was always very funny, and they'd show you how they cheated people.
So what were some of the things they showed you?
Oh, the magnets up sleeves and, palming cards and three-card Monte, all that sort of stuff. And also that it's all on a very, very... you know, it's for $10. It's not for $100,000. That's big. That's sort of something else. This is just for $10. Mm-hmm. Really, the truth is we're all suckers and we haven't a hope. You know, I know I'm a sucker. You know, I couldn't live with those guys. They could take my money any day.
Did they?
How do I know? That's part of the joy. You never know that you've been done.
Since the characters in this film, they are con artists, and part of the con is that you can't let other people really read your face.
Yes, of course.
And they're very tight-lipped, and they really can't reveal their true selves on the outside. So is it hard to get the actors to reveal their inner motivations to the audience since they're trying to hide it from the other characters in the film? Is it hard to direct a performance like that?
I think I do that instinctively. The last film I made, Dangerous Liaisons, that was quite a problem. That's to say, whenever anybody spoke, they were always lying, and eventually we found a way that you could actually see the dishonesty and the layers of deceit. It didn't so explicitly... it didn't present itself as a problem in the same way in this film. No, I mean, that's... somehow it was about whether about the fact that you didn't know whether somebody was lying or not, and only afterwards did you discover, oh, I see, they weren't saying what they meant at all.
Dangerous Liaisons was your first major Hollywood studio production.
Yes.
Right? And before that, the films that you were known for over here were My Beautiful Laundrette and Prick Up Your Ears and Sammy and Rosie Get Laid.
That's right.
And all of those were about class and race and homosexuality. Yes. And they were set in these rather netherworlds of London.
Yeah.
So you would seem to have been the least likely choice to direct this major studio production about the French aristocracy in the 18th century.
Yes, that's right.
How did you get that job?
Well, it took them a long time to come to me, though the writer, Christopher Hampton, who was also the producer, he said right from the beginning, the person you want is Stephen Frears. And they said, no, he makes those films, you know, about other subjects. But of course, he was right, because really, what I'm used to is working with very, very good writers, and Liaison was a wonderful script, and I knew Christopher very well, and I understood absolutely what he was writing about. So it wasn't difficult for me; I wasn't surprised, but I could see other people were.
Dangerous Liaisons, it's a period piece from the 18th century, and you could have gone the route of doing, you know, making it really opulent with large crowds and a lot of chateaus.
Yes, that was what I didn't want to do.
Why didn't you want to do that?
Well, I mean, because I've seen films like that and they don't interest me. And what I always liked about the script was that it wasn't about that. It was just about these people and how they interacted and how they revolved around each other and fell in love with each other or whatever, and that the story was absolutely wonderful, and that if you did put in a lot of sort of French 18th century period detail, that was somehow not very interesting. And I remember saying to the costume designer and to the set designer, both of whom were wonderfully talented men, I said, look, if people come out talking about the costumes, we've sort of failed. You know, it's the story which is so wonderful.
And you ended up using a lot of close-up shots on the
Well,
faces.
That's what you were talking about. That's because if you went in close, you saw that they were saying one thing and meaning another.
Oh.
It's a quite practical problem. How do you show dishonesty, or how do you show that someone doesn't mean what they say? And there are several answers. There are several, you know, there's no limit to the number of ways you can do that. But in that film, what worked was going in and seeing their eyes.
My guest is film director Stephen Frears. We'll talk more after a short break. This is Fresh Air. Stephen Frears is my guest. A few years ago, you directed Prick Up Your Ears,
mm-hmm.
and that was about the British playwright Joe Orton
mm-hmm.
and his homosexual relationship with Kenneth Halliwell. And Halliwell ended up bludgeoning Orton to death, and this all happened in the late 60s in London. And that was a project that you actually had first tried to do back in 1981, and it didn't happen, but you really persisted with it. What was it about his story that you really... made you really want to produce that film?
Well, it's an extraordinary story, isn't it? Mm. I mean, I imagine there were all the way through it, there were themes that interested me, and it was a very, very good script. I mean, they don't float around. When you find one, you're really pleased. I mean, we didn't make it in the early 80s because, you know, the climate shifted slightly in the mid-80s, and I think now you couldn't make it. But at that time, we were good, and we were able to get the money, and we went back and did more work on the script. So it was sort of, opportune. And we couldn't find an actor the first time, and then in the meantime, Gary Oldman, who says that he did come to see me in 1980, but he was growing up a bit, so that when we saw him again in 1986, he was that much older and, you know, had filled out and become a man of the right age.
Did you just say now you couldn't make that film?
I doubt if you could make that film now.
Why is that?
Because the legislation in Britain has become more repressive. And I don't think you could... You know, it was quite an expensive film because we had to recreate an earlier period. And I don't think you could go to somebody and sort of honourably ask them to invest in the film now. It would seem to me that the forces lined up against it were too strong. I mean, there's legislation which, you know, although no one, perhaps you wouldn't get prosecuted, you'd always be nervous that you were going to be prosecuted.
What legislation?
Oh, there's a clause, in some bill which makes it illegal to promote homosexuality. Well, I don't know what the words mean even, but, you know, someone might say, oh, this is promoting homosexuality, let's take them to court and cause havoc that way. So, you know, the whole climate is against that sort of work.
You studied law
yep.
at Trinity University?
Trinity College,
Trinity
Cambridge.
Trinity College. Mm. How did you end up working in film?
Well, it was very, very boring reading law. I mean, really dull. And while I was at Cambridge, I worked in the theatre a lot, and I thought that I wanted to work in the theatre for a living. And I got jobs in theatres, and then I found it not... like I wasn't as happy as I would have hoped. And then I met a film director who said, come and work on my film. So I went and worked on his film in complete bewilderment about what was going on. And then I made a film. And then what happens in life is you discover that people will employ you and actually, you know, pay you a wage to make a film. And so I learnt, as it were, as I went along. And then you one day think, oh, I see, I can actually make these films. Now perhaps I should think about what I make, why I photograph that and not that. And so it was a complete accident, really.
Uh-huh. Who was the film director?
Carol Rice.
And wasn't he part of, in France around this time in the 60s, there was...
In Britain.
Well, in France, there was the New Wave,
yes.
you know, cinema,
yes,
the New
I
Wave.
See
was there
saying.
A comparable thing
yes,
going on?
Yes, there was yes, absolutely. I mean, he and a man called Lindsay Anderson and Tony Richardson, they sort of changed the whole thing and... You know, those sort of rather old-fashioned films about the British stiff upper lip and the middle classes stopped being made and they started making films about ordinary people and ordinary lives, ordinary social problems, working-class people. And television really picked up from them and started showing life in Britain as it really is. I mean, you know, ordinary life, ordinary, regular life, not that sort of view... you know, as though life sort of came down from the Queen in some way, not that sort of official tourist view of Britain. Just the real thing.
Did you want to work in film?
Well, when I came down from university, I wanted to work for the BBC. Around the time, at the end of the 50s, the beginning of the 60s, it suddenly became a place where there were large numbers of young people who sort of had nowhere to go, very, very highly educated, intelligent people who wanted to find some means of expression. And the BBC became where they went to. And fellows at university when I was there, they were all getting jobs in the BBC. So the brightest people in the country went to this institution. And they sort of took it over. A few years later, it was the Beatles and, you know, things like that. But at that time, the BBC became... largely when it was run by Graham Greene's brother. It became a place where the very, very bright, energetic, lively people were to be found. And it was the most wonderful place where you were trained to sort of question the system and trained to show life as it really was and trained to be sceptical about official versions of things. It was a wonderful place and... I worked with Tom Stoppard and people like that, Alan Bennett, a lot. They were where they were writing for, because you couldn't get into films. Films was a sort of closed world. So young people, people of my age, just took this medium over.
You did make Gumshoe. How did that come about? But then you didn't make another film.
Well, I made that because it's a very, very good script that a friend of mine wrote and And we got Albert to be in it, so Albert Finney to be in it. So it was, you know, we got given the money, and it's. But I didn't really know what I was doing. Then I went into television, and what I was really doing, although I didn't know this at the time, was finding a place where I could learn my job.
And then My Beautiful Laundrette, which was your next film, actually started out as a TV show, and you.
Well, when I was sent the script of My Beautiful Laundrette, I said, "This is very, very good. This is like these television films we've been making. So let's." We shouldn't try to kid ourselves that this is for the cinema. So it went into the cinema by popular demand. I mean, it was a wonderful experience. I mean, you know, we weren't thinking, oh, this really would be good if it was in the cinema. It was suddenly started being shown in New York and in Paris, and it was a complete eye opener to us. We were all astonished.
For that film also, you were known for presenting homosexuality in a very humanizing kind of way, because
yes.
I think it was one of the first films that had a homosexual relationship in it, but it really wasn't about homosexuality.
Well, it didn't show them to be sort of, that it was a problem in any way.
It just came out very naturally.
Yes, yes.
Did you and Hanif Qureshi, who wrote the screenplay, did you discuss how you wanted to present that relationship?
I don't think I ever had a conversation with him. It just evolved naturally. I mean, the homosexuality was in the script, and I remember because it was a radical film. I remember being delighted that you had to be radical on all levels, which included relationships and sexual relationships. And then I discovered afterwards that I'd shot it like a sort of high school picture, and. You know, that it was really my memory of American teen films from the 50s. Sort of people necking in open cars and things like that. Boys and girls in the American films. And in fact, without thinking about it, I'd subverted it and made it a sort of parody of that.
Mm-hmm.
It was certainly true that it somehow was acceptable, and I always liked it that it didn't treat homosexuality as if it was some terrible disease.
Stephen Frears spoke with Fresh Air producer Amy Sallet. Frears' latest movie, The Grifters, is now out on video. This is Fresh Air. Let's see what's coming up on All Things Considered. Noah Adams is with us. Hi, Noah.
Hi, Terry. There is a Supreme Court ruling today in a Minnesota media case. If a reporter promises confidentiality to a source, that promise must be kept. It's being reported from northern Iraq that a deal has been made to provide autonomy for the Kurdistan region there. President Bush is now denying that the administration is holding back on an emergency plan to vaccinate children around the country against measles and mumps and polio, other diseases. There's said to be a vaccination crisis in the country, and we'll talk with the primary care director of the Parkland Memorial Hospital in Dallas. Dallas has had 3,000 cases of measles in 10 months.
Thanks, Noah. That and more on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. The Comedy Channel and the Ha Comedy Network merged this month to form a new cable comedy network called Comedy Central. TV critic David Bianculli says it's a great place to turn for laughs, old and new.
There's an old story about Steve Allen, and what other kind of story about Steve Allen is there, that goes something like this. In the early 50s, when his brand of wild, irreverent comedy was taking some people by storm and others by surprise, Allen was asked whether they got his TV show in some Midwestern place. Kansas, I think it was. "They see it," Allen replied, "but I'm not sure they get it." Today, those early Steve Allen shows, edited to fit a half-hour time slot but still full of funny stuff, are one of the many offerings on Comedy Central. I'm watching Comedy Central more and more these days, not only to pick up classics like The Steve Allen Show and Your Show of Shows, and more modern reruns such as SCTV, but also its new stuff. My favorite, a true guilty pleasure, is Mystery Science Theater 3000, which each week shows a very bad old movie and makes fun of it at the same time, thanks to a guy named Joel Hodgson and his robot sidekicks, who sit there and make jokes during the whole film. It's like a home version of the interactive movie experience of the Rocky Horror Picture Show, with more jokes per minute than anything this side of Robin Williams. A lot of the humor is visual, of course, so it's tough to give a true sense of it over the radio. But in the opening reel of Robot Monster, for example, a sudden shift to a prehistoric battle scene of two crocodiles poorly dressed up as dinosaurs generates these jokes from Hodgson and his robot buddies.
It's Gecko Roman wrestling.
Alligator turnovers all around.
Like dueling handbags.
Looks like outtakes from Mutual of Omaha 20 million BC.
Now, in the real movies, I hate people who talk during the film. But on TV, when these guys do it, it's a riot. The jokes come from everywhere in pop culture, and sometimes are so obscure you laugh out loud just because they tried them. One time, in a sword and sorcery film, a guy was hammering his anvil while repairing a broken sword. After the hammer struck twice, Joel said, "A Mark VII production," referring to the final hammer and anvil credit in the old Dragnet series. Now, I may be a sick puppy, but that's the sort of humor I love. Starting this week, another of my favorite sources of humor also shows up on Comedy Central when the network begins rerunning old classic Ernie Kovacs shows. Kovacs did stuff with TV's technology back in the 50s that other people have been stealing ever since. And his humor, too, was largely visual. There's no way to describe, for those who haven't seen it, the goofy appeal of the Nairobi Trio. Three people dressed up in gorilla suits pretending to play musical instruments while hitting each other over the head. But if you ever saw it, you never forgot it. Or the music they always pretended to play. The last time I found this much to watch on a new cable channel was when TNT premiered, with its great mix of old MGM movies and Looney Tunes cartoons. Comedy Central, with Allen, Kovacs, SCTV, and Mystery Science Theater 3000, is one of the best things to happen to TV this year. I'm laughing, but I'm not kidding.
David Bianculli is TV critic for the New York Post. Fresh Air's senior producer is Danny Miller. Our engineers this week are Richard Parker and Joyce Lieberman. Chris Spurgeon directs the show. I'm Terry Gross.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, by this and other NPR member stations, and by a grant from Talbots, retailers of women's classic clothing and accessories through stores and catalogs. 1-800-8-TALBOTS. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, writer Ivan Klima talks with us about the artistic climate in his country, Czechoslovakia, after the fall of communism. I'm Terry Gross. I hope you'll join us for the next Fresh Air.